This is VOA News. I'm Jim Bertel. U.S. President Donald Trump's impeachment trial will begin Tuesday in the U.S. Senate. Over the weekend, the Democratic lawmakers managing the impeachment case filed a brief laying out their arguments supporting charges of abuse of power and obstruction of Congress against the president. The president's legal team issued a rejection of the House impeachment. On ABC This Week, Democratic Congressman Adam Schiff, the impeachment manager, says he continues to be concerned about a fair trial.
Will the senators allow the House to call witnesses, to introduce documents? That is the foundational issue on which everything else rests, and one thing that the public is overwhelmingly in support of, and that is a fair trial.
On the same program, Alan Dershowitz, one of the president's lawyers, says voters should give the final verdict, not Congress.
I think many presidents in the past have made foreign policy decisions to enhance their electoral prospects. And if people think that this president did that, that's a factor that should enter into the decision who to vote for, among many, many other factors.
Mr. Trump is only the third U.S. president to face an impeachment trial. Afghan officials say the Taliban executed six members of the same family in the country's north. AP's Charles de Ledesma reports.
The killings, which took place in a remote village in the country's north, include an infant girl. The insurgent group has denied any involvement, saying the attack on Saturday was triggered by a personal dispute. However, local officials say the family was accused by the Taliban of working in prostitution and that the group had first sentenced them to death for immoral acts, then stormed the house and opened fire. The infant girl's mother and twin sister survived, but both of the child's legs had to be amputated. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
And for news in the palm of your hand, download the VOA mobile app. This is VOA News. China says 17 more people have become infected with a new coronavirus strain. This is fanning fears it will spread further as hundreds of millions of people travel to celebrate the upcoming Lunar New Year. Meanwhile, U.S. health officials are now screening for the virus at three airports. More from VOA's Michelle Quinn.
The virus is believed to have started in Wuhan, a city in central China. It belongs to the same family of coronaviruses that includes severe acute respiratory syndrome, SARS. SARS killed nearly 800 people globally during an outbreak 17 years ago. It also started in China. Adding to health officials' concerns is that many of the 1.4 billion people of China are expected to travel abroad during the Lunar New Year holiday. At New York's John F. Kennedy International Airport, one man in transit with his wife and children said the health screening was a simple process.
15 minutes. Very simple, and they made it very easy to get through.
Screening is also happening in other cities around the world. Michelle Quinn, VOA News, San Francisco.
Leaders from 12 countries are meeting in Germany today in hopes of laying a foundation for a lasting ceasefire between Libya's rival governments. Turkey and Russia helped broker a fragile ceasefire in Libya, which took effect last week, but both sides have accused the other of breaking it. One of the hopes of the summit is to curb continued foreign interference in the conflict. The bodies of the 11 Ukrainians who died when an Iranian missile shot down a passenger plane have arrived in Ukraine for a farewell ceremony. They were among the 176 people killed in the January 8th catastrophe when a Ukrainian Airlines plane heading to Kyiv was brought down shortly after takeoff from Tehran. Forecasters are warning of severe storms in Australia's fire-hit state of Victoria. Recent heavy rains have dampened many of the country's bushfires. Meanwhile, Reuters' Emer McCarthy reports tourists are beginning to return to the country.
Coming into dock, the first cruise ship returned to bushfire-ravaged Kangaroo Island in Australia on Sunday. Kangaroo Island is renowned for its wildlife, but the recent bushfires have burned more than 200,000 hectares of land, putting several species at risk. For passengers, supporting the local economy is a top priority.
And we just want to come ashore to spend some money and to try and help the locals.
The Australian government also said on Sunday it will allocate more than $50 million to the country's lucrative tourism industry. Tourism accounts for more than 3% of the country's annual economic output.
That's Reuters' Emer McCarthy, and I'm Jim Bertel, VOA News.
evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
So we are wondering, why is it that this case is very special? Because they have arrested people before. They have denied bail people before in the discourse that they want to investigate the matter. They want to jeopardize with the investigation. So we are wondering, what is it that they are talking about? I think what they are saying is not true.
An ultimatum by a Malawian political pressure group demands an inquiry into bribery allegations ends Monday.
Trying to prepare a smooth transition of power from Prime Minister to the one which will be elected after he has decided now he's stepping down.
The Lesotho ruling parliamentarians to soon consider a replacement for Prime Minister Dr. Thomas Tabani.
Providing the Gabonese with the leadership I could provide with the framework of a clear balance of power which allows the Gabonese people to stand against the regime for more than 3 years.
And the main Gabonese opposition leader expresses concern about the health condition of President Ali Bongo Ondimba. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. The Malawian Human Rights Defenders Coalition, or HRDC, a political pressure group, says the Anti-Corruption Bureau appears to be delaying on investigating allegations of attempt to bribe judges who will decide the outcome of the disputed presidential election. Gift Trappens, vice president of the group, says the 72-hour ultimatum the HRDC issued to the anti-graft agency ends on Monday. Trappens told me there are a series of activities the group plans to undertake to pressure the Anti-Corruption Bureau if it fails to expedite inquiry into the attempted bribery allegations.
So it has taken long for the Anti-Corruption Bureau to act on the matter. So for us, I think our petition to them was just to remind them about their obligation, but as well to speed up the process. Because if we delay in arresting, but as well in naming the individuals, it means that people will not accept the judgment either way. So we want the Anti-Corruption Bureau to be proactive because the case itself is very important for the judgment itself as well.
But Gift, if the Anti-Corruption Bureau, the ACB, goes ahead to name these alleged people, don't you think it will undermine or impede the investigation currently underway?
You know, the Anti-Corruption Bureau has always hide behind the investigations. This is a straightforward case. It's a very simple case. There were individuals who wanted to bribe the judges, and the judges they were already interviewed. So it's not a complicated case. We have had cases before the Anti-Corruption Bureau where they have even named and issued a statement whenever they have caught individuals who have small positions. So they have even put press releases in the media. So we are also shocked. Malawians are shocked that the Anti-Corruption Bureau is shielding the individuals. Because if someone is a suspect, why should you hide his or her name? It's a suspect.
What will the HRDC do if the Anti-Corruption Bureau fails to meet your deadline of Monday?
Actually, we will have another course of action. And actually, we have promised the Anti-Corruption Bureau that we are going to also announce to Malawians, we are going to mobilize Malawians for the next course of action. Actually, that action will make sure that we are able to compel the Director General to name and arrest those individuals. Of course, the justice should not be selected.
Your critics are saying that your pressure on the Anti-Corruption Bureau is influencing or trying to put political pressure on them, which shouldn't be so. Officials at the Anti-Corruption Bureau should be allowed to freely investigate this independently, so when the perpetrators are found guilty or are found to have been complicit in this, then they could be dealt with in accordance with Malawian law. Your reaction to that?
It's not true. The Anti-Corruption Bureau has never been independent in the first place. We have always raised the challenges that the Anti-Corruption Bureau has faced. The first thing is that there are laws that make the Anti-Corruption Bureau not to be independent. The appointment is done by the president. So we want to reform to make sure that we're able to free this institution. But also historically, we have had cases that have stalled. Malawians are aware that the president was linked to a corruption case of 145 million Malawian kwacha. Up to now, that case has stalled. So Malawians are aware how an independent is the actual Anti-Corruption Bureau. So they always hide behind the investigation. So what we are saying is that we know that we are investigating, but because they received this conference last year in November, and yet the judgment is coming the next 18 days. So they cannot speed up this process. Malawians do not trust the judgment coming from the judges, either way.
But they have to investigate to find out the truth. These are mere allegations. There's no proof. Isn't it why they are investigating to find out the proof or evidence to possibly prosecute them if they are found guilty?
We'll give you an example. If it was an opposition person who was arrested, they would have even arrested them and imprisoned them, even denying them bail. They would always say that we should deny these people bail because we're investigating. So we are wondering, why is it that this case is very special? Because they have arrested people before. They have denied bail people before. In the discuss that they want to investigate the matter, they would jeopardize with the investigation. So we are wondering, what is it that they are talking about? I think what they are saying is not true. I'm telling you, it's not true. I think they are shielding justice. But as a JRBC, we are going to push the matter because we know, we are Malawians, we have known our SEB in terms of how they have worked.
Gift Trappens is the Vice President of the Human Rights Defenders Coalition, or HRDC, a Malawian political pressure group. He spoke with me from the capital, Lilongwe. Parliamentarians from the Lesotho ruling party, the All Basotho Congress, or ABC, will soon make a decision to replace Prime Minister Thomas Tabani when he officially steps down, according to Foko Moshoeshoe, majority leader in parliament. Calling for reconciliation and peace within the ABC party, local media quotes the Prime Minister as saying he would soon step down as both the country's leader as well as head of the ruling party. He, however, stopped short of giving a specific time to step down. ABC Parliamentary Majority Leader Fako Mashoeshoe tells me the Prime Minister will soon retire from the daily rigors of running the affairs of the mountainous Southern African Kingdom.
Actually, we have a coalition agreement. In the coalition agreement, it has been indicated that the party which has got a majority is the one who will come up with the prime minister, meaning that ABC is the majority in the coalition. So meaning that even though our prime minister is intending to retire, definitely the successor will come from ABC members. So meaning that I will call a caucus, then sit down and ask each and every MP to contribute that, which is the member that you are willing to be a successor from Prime Minister's office. Then we'll take it from there, and then we'll take the majority. If the majority says a certain name, then we'll take that name and give it to the parliament, then that person will become the Prime Minister of Lesotho.
How is the current situation in the country politically, and do you think it will be advantageous for the ABC to maintain its dominance and be retained, looking at the supposed scandals, including the Prime Minister's wife absconding when a judge has issued warrant against her?
Actually, on that issue of Prime Minister's wife, I won't say much because that is an issue of the police, which are investigating them, which are still looking for the First Lady. They are even just made a statement they are looking for the First Lady. As long as they caught her, maybe she will be brought to the police and be asked the questions relating to those suspicious as a suspect of the late Medipulelo Tabani.
Prime Minister Dr. Thomas Tabani has called for reconciliation within the party. How was this taken, and do you think the reported rift within the ABC can be rectified?
Really, I don't think is there any risk at all. Let me just tell you from the beginning. All this, it has been started a long time ago. If you still remember, we lost one of our MPs from Mahona constituency. Even if you are aware you are following Lesotho's politics at that time, that's when he started introducing this thing of reconciling, building unity. In fact, the backbenchers, the guys which are not the MPs, which are not the ministers, they sit down and tell themselves, and then they ask the chairperson, which is me, to call them together, to bring them together, to sit down and talk about everything. And after talking everything until we get to the agreement, saying that enough is enough. Now we are uniting ABC. We are no more having functions like before. Now we want to the committees who have been elected between first and second to be in an office, which is the one who makes matters worse in our movement. Because all of this thing is the committee which was elected by the members of the ABC. As long as that committee is in the office, there will be no more crisis. Everything will go smoothly. Even the successors are going to just sit down and agree one minute. Things will go fully, smoothly. And now even the situation is calm because no more tensions like before. Because everywhere, before we end up having this kind of working together as one ABC, really, there are no more conflicts. There are no more, everything is smooth and the country is calm. Everything is silent. We want to see Lesotho prospering. We want to see Lesotho stability and stable in economy as well.
So what led to the resolution of the tension that you spoke about? Was it because of neighboring South Africa, helping with one of its officials coming to Lesotho to help with the process to ease the tension, or it was within the rank and file of the ABC itself?
No. Actually, it was the rank and file of the ABC, meaning that the backbenchers, that the one who started this thing. This was the thing that came in. Even the delegation from SADC, everything was all over. Even the resolutions we had, four resolutions as the rank and file of ABC MPs. We have four resolutions. The first resolution was talking about the unity, and then the other one was talking about the committee which was elected on the 1st and 2nd of February should be in the office. The third one was asking the leader, the new executive and the MP to have a press conference. That's what they did. Another thing of just trying to prepare a smooth transition of power from Prime Minister to the one which will be elected after he has decided now he's stepping down. As he has told the nation that he's getting tired. He has been working for such a long time. He was involved in the National Party government, in Congress government. Now he has been involved in so many occasions. Now he's getting tired. He doesn't have energy anymore. That's what he said. And that's what he has said in the country.
Fako Moshoeshoe is the majority leader of the Lesotho ruling party, the All Basotho Congress in Parliament. He spoke with me from the capital, Maseru. In Gabon, supporters of the ruling party are accusing the opposition of using President Ali Bongo's health to score cheap political points. This after the president received medical treatment in London and his health reportedly deteriorated during a visit. Opposition supporters say the president's ailment prevents him from running the day-to-day affairs of the Central African country. They called on him to step down and hand over power, a demand supporters rejected as regrettably petty and unfortunate. In part two of my interview with the Gabonese main opposition leader, Jean Ping tells me the president's health challenge prevents him from effectively running the affairs of the country. You just spoke about Ali Bongo's health. Some people are saying you are using his health to score cheap political points instead of wishing him well so he could feel better. How do you respond to that?
Well, it is not fair. Everybody knows that I win the election, the last election. The whole international community, Europeans, Americans, Africans, everybody knows that I won the elections with more than 65% of the elections. So how can you imagine something else?
What do you think is the best way forward to resolve what many people have described as the ongoing political tension in Gabon?
I think that to be efficient, therefore not to know how efficient can be the international community to solve political crises in some countries. And fortunately, in the case of Gabon, it seems to me that there is no truth or strong reaction from the community, despite all of the evidences provided.
Some say in Gabon that the international community is doing its bit to help resolve the tension in Gabon. What is your take?
I think that the international public opinion is blind when it does not take the real measures of the Gabonese crisis, which is not a mere situation of tension. One must not wait for a country like Gabon to plunge into civil war and displacement before hearing the voice of the international community in the end. Once of the proof that Gabon is in a critical situation is that the resistance that Gabonese people imposed to the regime has continued for more than 3 years, and the regime, considered as illegitimate, is unable to break the citizens' determination. It is the long standoff between the population and the power in the history of Gabon.
So, in your opinion, what is the best steps forward? How do you resolve this?
In my opinion, the solution lies in the respect of the Gabonese people vote. They have been demanding for more than 3 years. The Gabonese people vote, they have been demanding for more than 3 years. The Gabonese people demand the recognition of the truth of the ballot, the real results from the ballot, thus putting an end to the current usurpation of the power. We take up this solution on our own account while remaining faithful to the commitment to achieve the political changes the Gabonese people wish. Indeed, they granted me more than 65%, as I told you before, of the votes in the election of August 27, 2016. To achieve this end, my plan consisted particularly in 1. Providing the Gabonese with the leadership I proved, provide with the framework of a clear balance of power which allows the Gabonese people to stand against the regime for more than 3 years. 2. Maintaining a hardcore of resistance with the political leaders by my side. 3. Widening the political circle in order to prepare the country for national reconstitution and reconciliation. 4. Putting an end to the disintegration of the state.
Jean Ping is the main Gabonese opposition leader and former chairperson for the African Union Commission. He spoke with me from the capital, Libreville. Cameroonian teachers are protesting what they say is growing violence against them by both students and their parents. The teachers are urging the government to protect them and reinstate corporal punishment. They say the absence of corporal punishment is encouraging the abuse of teachers. This week, several attacks on teaching staffs were reported, including one in which a teenage student fatally stabbed his teacher. For VOA, Moki Edwin Kezaka reports from the Cameroonian capital, Yaoundé.
Students shout Saturday at a government-run school in Obala, a town on the outskirts of Cameroon's capital, Yaoundé, protesting the principal's decision to destroy all mobile phones and knives seized from children Friday at the school. One of their senior discipline masters, Narcisse Ateba, says the students use mobile phones to access social media platforms that promote violence, and they also use sharp objects such as knives to attack their peers and teachers. He says that some parents and students will want to harass or beat him up, but he has nonetheless decided to publicly destroy the 15 mobile phones found and seized by teachers from students Friday because it is illegal to use them in classrooms. He says he will not allow students to come to school with razor blades, box cutters, and knives. The destruction of the mobile phones and the peaceful marches to administrative offices and palaces are part of protests by teachers at Obala against what they say are increasing acts of violence against them. This week, a 16-year-old student at the public school in Corbison in a neighborhood in Yaoundé is accused of using a knife to stab his mathematics teacher, who died of excessive bleeding as he was being rushed to a hospital. The school said the student insisted on using his mobile phone in class against the teacher's instruction. The student was arrested and detained by police and will be answering charges including premeditated killing. Another teacher this week was battered by students in Douala for questioning why they were late to school. And yet another teacher in Douala was beaten by a parent and fell into a coma. The parent was said to be angry with the teacher's decision to use corporal punishment on his son as punishment for making noise in class. In another incident, a student used a machete to chop off another student's finger in Obala after a fight during a soccer match. Elvis Usinye, an official with the Cameroon Teachers Trade Union in Yaoundé, says attacks by students on teachers intensified in 2015 when Cameroon prohibited teachers from beating or severely punishing students.
When a minister says that teachers are not supposed to administer corporal punishment to students, the student now sees that he has the right to bring disorder because there is nothing the teacher can do in class. The minister should revisit the text and permit teachers to administer corporal punishment with caution.
Usinye said the high wave of drug consumption by students and the inability of teachers to use corporal punishment because they have been prohibited from doing so is also responsible for the wave of attacks. Nalova Lyonga, Cameroon Minister of Secondary Education, says corporal punishment cannot be tolerated because it is an abuse on the rights of students who are mostly children.
What I've told the teachers is that they themselves have to make a distinction between a disciplinary case and a case which becomes a criminal case. And they should be able to report to the special police at the disposal of the schools.
Lyonga said Cameroon students are exposed to other cultures of the world because of the increasing use of mobile phones, and they gain access to social media platforms that promote violence while neglecting the peace and unity that Cameroon traditionally preaches. Carol Kayum, president of Reference Citizens, a non-governmental organization that promotes citizenship education, has been visiting schools in Yaoundé to educate both teachers and students against violence. She says Cameroon should uphold its culture of non-violence to prevent the growing number of assaults on other students and teachers.
Our cultures are rich. Parents should transmit them to children, and also there should be communication between schools and parents so that we know what our children are doing in school, and we also tell the school authorities what our children do at home. School authorities and parents should control the use of drugs.
Kayum said many people now join the teaching profession because they lack jobs and not for the love of teaching, and as such, they are not loved by students. The students also have complained they are harassed by some teachers whom they accuse of behaving poorly or not teaching well. The Cameroon Ministry of Secondary Education has recorded 40 violent attacks by students on their peers, 22 attacks on teachers, and 15 attacks by parents on teachers within the past month. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
And a survey of 16,000 millennials in 16 different countries at peace and at war indicates a majority as nervous about the future, and a large plurality believes heightened global tensions are likely to lead to a catastrophic war. For VOA, Lisa Schlein has more from Geneva.
The ICRC survey finds millennials are deeply pessimistic about the future they face. The results indicate this generation of young people, now between the ages of 25 and 39, is worried about future conflicts and nuclear weapons. Other top concerns include unemployment, increasing poverty, and terrorism. Among those surveyed, 47% think there will be a third world war in their lifetime. However, 84% believe the use of nuclear weapons is never acceptable. ICRC legal advisor Nishat Nishat calls this extremely encouraging.
And I think there's something very encouraging about the fact that millennials, my generation, and people in the world, I think generally now, have understood the sort of catastrophic effects nuclear weapons could have and how those effects would just be unacceptable regardless of the circumstances in which these would be used.
Nevertheless, Nishat notes, 54% believe it is more likely than not that a nuclear attack will occur in the next decade. The survey reveals a worrisome lack of respect for basic human values enshrined in international law. For example, international law bans torture and inhumane treatment under all circumstances. Yet 37% of millennials surveyed believe torture is acceptable under some circumstances. ICRC Deputy Head of Resource Mobilization, Daniel Littlejohn Carrillo, says an overwhelming majority of respondents believe combatants should avoid civilian casualties as much as possible. However, he expresses concern that 15% support any actions needed to win a war, regardless of civilian casualties.
This strongly justifies also the work of the ICRC, we feel, in making sure that we continue to reach people, and particularly that 15% of the population, to ensure that messages, that pressure on policymakers, on decision makers, is really geared and oriented towards reducing civilian casualties as much as possible.
Overall, 73% of respondents say addressing mental health needs of conflict victims is just as important as providing food, water, and shelter. The Geneva Conventions, which regulate how wars are fought, were adopted 70 years ago. A large majority of millennials surveyed believes more should be done to limit the ways war can be fought. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa Sports with Douglas Mpuga, and that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs, and music from our African collection. But first, more than 2 years after France promised to return colonial-era treasures to their African homes, Benin, ostensibly the first recipient of the groundbreaking policy, still awaits them. But on Friday, a small museum outside Cotonou celebrated the return of antique royal scepters gifted by a group of Paris gallery owners. For VOA, Lisa Bryan has the story from the French capital, Paris.
In 2017, French President Emmanuel Macron sparked joy and unease when he announced colonial-era treasures from Africa would be returned or shared through exhibitions and loans. The first gesture would be the speedy return to Benin of 26 objects looted by French colonial forces in 1892. But turning that promise into reality is not so easy. Only last December did France's culture minister offer a concrete timetable, saying the objects now housed at Paris's leading African art museum will be returned by 2021. Enter a group of Paris Left Bank gallery owners whose private efforts are moving much more quickly than public ones. They have not only acquired and returned precious antiques to Benin for years, but raised funds to build a small museum outside Cotonou to house them. On Friday, that institution, the Petit Musée de la Rocade, welcomed one of its biggest troves to date, more than two dozen pieces, including 17 scepters coming from the ancient kingdom of Dahomey, located in parts of what is modern-day Benin. Speaking by phone from Cotonou, Paris gallery owner Robert Valois says the gesture doesn't constitute restitution of ill-gotten art. Instead, he and his colleagues bought the antiques in France with the specific intent of returning them to Benin. Macron's restitution promise has been more complicated to realize. It means changing French laws and ensuring old and fragile pieces are properly housed. With French support, Benin is building a new museum in Abomey, once the capital of Dahomey Kingdom. José Plia, head of Benin's National Agency for Heritage Promotion and Tourism Development, spoke to VOA about the process last year.
We have to have the good condition, temperature, isolation, conservation to welcome them. A lot of things have to be done. The training of all the conservators in Benin, how to protect those pieces.
Despite the roadblocks, Macron's restitution vows add pressure on other European countries and museums with African collections. Fadwa says he and his gallery group are not part of such debates. They're following their own counsel. And what's important to them is that the objects return to their countries of origin. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Impuga. Hello, Douglas.
Hi, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. In African football, Cameroon announced that the 2021 Africa Cup of Nations will start on January 9th. The tournament was scheduled to take place in June and July, but was changed because of unfavorable weather in the country at that time of year. The 2019 tournament in Egypt was the first one to be held in the summer. Before that, the Cup of Nations had been held in January and February, clashing with the European domestic season. June and July in Cameroon are during the country's rainy season. The change back to the January start means that the tournament will not clash with the expanded Club World Cup being held in China in June 2021. CAF confirmed that the 2021 Africa Cup of Nations will now be played in Cameroon from January 9th to February 6th, 2021. Cameroon had been scheduled to host the 2019 Cup of Nations, but was stripped of that honor in November 2018 because of delays in the progress of Cameroon's preparations. Meanwhile, CAF has rearranged the continent's qualifying campaigns for the 2022 World Cup and the 2021 Africa Cup of Nations. Nations Cup qualifiers had been due to begin in August, but will now start in March. Qualifiers for the 2022 World Cup have been postponed to October to accommodate the change. Second rounds of qualifiers will be held in March, with one round in June prior to the final qualifying period from August 3rd to September 8th. Once the 24 teams for next year's Nations Cup have been determined, World Cup qualifying will start in October, with another qualifying round following the next month. The draw for the group stage of the 2022 World Cup qualifying is set to take place this Tuesday, January 21st. In athletics, Kenenisha Bekele, the second fastest marathon runner of all time, will take on world record holder Eliud Kipchoge at the London Marathon in April. Ethiopia's 37-year-old Bekele was only 2 seconds off Kipchoge's world record in Berlin in September. Since turning to the road in 2014, Bekele's marathon career has been hindered by various injuries. But after coming so close to toppling Kipchoge's world record in the German capital last year, the London Marathon will be an interesting watch. Ethiopian duo Mesnet Jeremiu and Mule Waschan have also been named in the field, meaning all three podium finishers from 2019 and four of the eight fastest men in history will race. Kipchoge, the 35-year-old Kenyan, has brought new glamour and attention to the distance by breaking the two-hour barrier in a specially designed event in Vienna in October. Kipchoge had already set the world record in 2018 in Berlin. He has run 12 official marathons since turning to the road in 2013. He has won 11 of them, with a second-place finish behind compatriot Wilson Kipsang in Berlin in his debut year, the only blemish on record. His victory at the Rio 2016 secured the Olympic gold that had eluded him on track. Bekele turned to marathon after a dream career on the track and cross-country courses. At just 21, he broke both the 5,000 and 10,000 meters world records in the space of 9 days in 2004, before winning his first Olympic gold over the long distance in Athens later that year. He followed up that success with the 5,000 meters and 10,000 meters double in Beijing 4 years later. His world record marks over 5,000 and 10,000 meters are still stand today. He won on his marathon debut in Paris in 2014 and has since claimed the Berlin title twice. Interestingly, Bekele and Kipchoge have met 20 times across all surfaces and distances. And women's marathon world record holder Bridget Kosgei says she's looking forward to defending her title at this year's London Marathon. Organizers announced the 25-year-old Kenyan inclusion last week. Kosgei broke Britain's Paul Radcliffe's 16-year-old record at the Chicago Marathon in October. Kosgei's record-breaking run came 6 months after winning the London Marathon for the first time. The women's field is also packed with talented Kenyans, including 2018 London Marathon winner Vivian Cheruiyot, three-time Berlin Marathon champion Gladys Cherono, current world champion Ruth Cheptegetich, and Jocelyn Jepchekosgei, the 2019 New York City Marathon champion. And that's about it for this edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Now, back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. And now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's 1 month's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. Today, the state of Libya and its people is being discussed at a conference in Berlin, Germany, a conference convened by the German government. You may recall that over a week ago, a smaller conference was convened in Moscow by the Russian president to search for a ceasefire. But the ceasefire agreement was only between those fighting on the ground. Even though there was an agreement for a ceasefire, the world old Khalifa Haftar left Moscow without signing the agreement. Subsequently agreed to it, but this is an unstable ceasefire. Today's conference in Berlin is much larger. It is being attended by 11 heads of states, including 4 heads of international organizations, including the United Nations, the African Union, and the League of Arab States. What will this conference tackle? Obviously, they would also want to have a stable ceasefire in Libya. And with that, they would try to work out some monitoring device to monitor this compliance with the ceasefire. There is as yet no agreement whether such a monitoring group to be that from the United Nations, or whether it will be outside of the United Nations. There is also talk of having an arms embargo to get out those who are supplying arms to the various militia in Libya. That will be discussed and agreed to, if possible. There is also the need to look at matters of reconciliation between the various forces within Libya and try to bring them together to have an agreed national government, because the UN recognized government is not recognized by many other Libyan groups. So that will be a subject of discussion at this conference. There is also a troubling issue which has been flagged by some European members attending the conference. This is the signing of an MOU between Turkey and the UN-recognized government in Tripoli that gave inordinate advantage to Turkey in the Mediterranean. These Europeans oppose the MOU, so does the General Haftar, and also Egypt and United Arab Emirates. This may be a very difficult issue to resolve. And some are asking, why did the UN-recognized government sign such an agreement with Turkey? I think they forget that we are living in an era when the exercise of diktat has become normalized in the conduct of international relations. This is when powerful states flag themselves, apply pressure on weak and small states. This practice, of course, is unhelpful, but is not very common. So these are the issues which will be discussed, but we must ask ourselves the question, why is Africa playing such a low profile role at the conference? Of course, there will be the head of the African Union, and it is essential because it has been suggested that any agreement reached in Berlin will be sent to the Security Council for its blessing. And unless it could be proved that the Africans are in agreement, it will be difficult for the Security Council to endorse it. But can these Africans say that they were involved thoroughly in all aspects of the agreement? This is something which they will have to determine for themselves. But Africans must ask themselves, why in the 1970s did the OAU show more vigor in defending African interests? For example, after Israel occupied the Sinai, the OAU made it a kind of principle to defend Egypt and ask Israel to withdraw from the Sinai because they said this is occupied African land. In 1971, the OAU sent two high-level delegations to meet with the then Prime Minister Golda Meir to emphasize Africa's concern that an African land was being occupied by Israel. And in 1973, at the wake of the Yom Kippur War, all African states unanimously broke relations with Israel. So where is African leadership taking Africa today? This is a burning question which Africans must continue to ask. Because outside powers, of course, will come to Libya and they will look for their interest, particularly oil. But where is Africa? I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. And it's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to relax and reflect, a flashback with music from the continent. You hear from Salif Keita with Mosolu, and then Julie Sentero featuring Ruti and Kimbaye will come your way with Yarabi, and then Sam Fran Thomas with African Typic Collection. We'll be right back.
That was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoyed the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America in Washington. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Saleh, reporter Douglas Impuga, producer Saida Hamdoun, and our engineer for today, Nelson Lopez, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, when the moon is not full, the stars shine more brightly. I'm your host, Peter Clotter in Washington. Good evening, Africa. We'll be right back.